My name is Michael McCusker. On this windy, gusty, rainy Thursday morning, we've had a kaleidoscope of weather this last week. Today's is back to normal marine conditions. Well, there's a couple things I'd like to read this morning, both of which I have written, so I'd like to give a disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos. The first I'd like to read is something I wrote a number of years ago while I was working at the Columbia Maritime Museum, and I wrote it for the museum's publication, The Quarter Deck, and then reprinted it in my newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, in 2006 in its January edition. It's about yesterday's anniversary of the Triumph disaster, as it has been called, where 7 people died on the bar, 5 of them Coast Guardsmen, and 3 boats went down. 4 boats went down, I beg your pardon, 3 of them Coast Guard boats, 1 of them the Triumph. And yesterday marked the half-century anniversary, 50 years ago, January 12th, 1961. So I'd like to read this story about it, or this article. And I wrote it, so again, the disclaimer's in place. They don't have to come back. The Columbia River Bar is the place where the River of the West and the mighty Pacific Ocean meet, with dramatic and often violent results. Hundreds of ships and boats have been lost on the bar. Parentheses, including one I was aboard, the Meteor, in 1972, a tuna boat and crab boat. Close parentheses. Seafarers and river cruisers have lost their lives by the score. Mariners call it the graveyard of the Pacific. U.S. Coast Guardsmen are required to respond to every maritime distress signal along this rough stretch, no matter what weather or time of day. They have saved countless numbers of vessels and lives, parentheses, including my own, close parentheses, an average of 600 persons a year on the Lower Columbia alone. They are ordinary men and women who take extraordinary risks in small boats and aircraft. Most of the time they get back safely, but sometimes their luck runs out. One January night, 50 years ago, the Columbia River Bar claimed the lives of 5 Coast Guardsmen and 2 ocean fishermen they attempted to rescue. 3 Coast Guard vessels were lost, as well as the fishing boat they set out to save from gale-stricken seas. 2 men who survived that failed rescue attempt visited Astoria in the spring of 1990 to recount the tragic night of January 12, 1961. Darrell Joseph Murray and Larry Edwards were Coast Guard coxswains of 2 of the 3 rescue boats that sank that night. The coxswain on the 3rd boat died in the attempt, along with most of his crew. When Murray walked into the Columbia River Maritime Museum, it was as if he had seen an apparition. Visiting the museum that day was Larry Edwards' son, Blaine Edwards, a fisherman at the time, who so resembled his father as a young man that Murray felt for a moment he was in the presence of his old friend, looking just as he did 3 decades earlier. Murray had never forgotten that night of 1961. Even after 20 years spent in the Coast Guard in motor lifeboat stations, the disaster continued to affect and define his life. The events of that evening began late in the afternoon of January 12th with a distress call from the fishing boat Mermaid, received by Cape Disappointment Lifeboat Station just inside the mouth of the Columbia River on the Washington side. The Mermaid of Ilwaco, Washington, had lost its rudder trying to beat into the river ahead of a storm and was drifting helplessly toward the surf north of Peacock Spit. Murray, a bosun's mate, described as a petty officer of long experience and established competence in lifeboat stations, quickly dispatched 2 boats. I sent Larry Edwards out in a 36-foot boat, and I took a 40-foot boat, Murray said during his visit to the Maritime Museum 21 years ago. The solid and sturdy, but slow, 36-foot boat was the standard motor lifeboat used by the Coast Guard at the time. It was constructed of wood and was capable of righting itself if capsized. The 40-footer did not have that capability. Not meant to be used as a lifeboat, it generally served as a utility and patrol craft. The 40-footer was not designed for rough water, but it was faster than the 36-footer, Murray explained. I thought I could get out there and get a tow line to the Mermaid before it hit the beach and turn the tow over to Larry when he reached me. What happened instead was that the weather, bad to begin with, continued to get worse. Unable to establish direct radio contact with the Mermaid, Murray lost valuable time searching for the fishing vessel. Neither of the Coast Guard boats had radar. The Jana Joe, a fish boat from Il Waco, skippered by Roy Gunnery, assisted by relaying Mermaid's calls. It was after dark before Murray was able to talk to the Mermaid. I told them to turn their spotlight on the clouds, Murray said. I spotted them immediately after that. When I reached the boat, I told the two men aboard they should transfer to my boat. They refused, so we took them under tow. Edwards, in the 36-foot boat, finally reached the other two vessels near Buoy 1, which marks the beginning of the shipping channel into the Columbia River. His boat had taken a beating crossing the bar. It was leaking at the seams, and the radio antenna was broken. He did not take over the tow. Plans had changed due to the worsening weather. The 52-foot motorboat, lifeboat Triumph from Point Adams on the Oregon side of the river, was coming out to take the Mermaid in. The Triumph was a 25-year veteran of rescues in all types of weather at the Columbia River Bar. It was wooden-hulled, one of only two boats of the same design, built in 1935. The man at the helm that night was bosun's mate John L. Culp, a 31-year-old career Coast Guardsman who was considered an excellent lifeboat commander. By the time Culp left the Point Adams station, 4 miles upriver from the bar, gale winds from the southwest had whipped up huge swells. The Triumph did not reach the other three boats at Buoy 1 until 2 hours later. Culp took over the tow of the Mermaid from Murray. All four vessels started toward the river. Then everything went wrong at once. Murray's boat capsized, trying to cross the bar. A few minutes later, Triumph went over while attempting to retrieve a parted tow line to the Mermaid. Culp and four of his men were lost. Only one member of the crew of Triumph survived, later washing ashore unharmed. Murray and his two-man crew survived only because of Edwards' quick thinking. His boat was near Murray's when it overturned. Responding to the 40-footer, Edwards smashed against the upended keel of the other boat during the rescue of the three men. He turned his battered lifeboat out to sea and headed for the Coast Guard lightship Columbia, anchored on station about 7 miles outside the river entrance. In the meantime, the Mermaid, still afloat, was taken into tow once again by another 36-foot boat sent from Point Adams to assist in the rescue. The 36-footer's coxswain also set out for the lightship, but lost the Mermaid to a large swell that capsized the fishing vessel, killing the three men aboard, two brothers, and a survivor from Triumph they had pulled from the water. After another hour of plowing through full throttle through the storm, the 36-foot boat, piloted by Larry Edwards, only barely reached lightship Columbia. The stern was awash, the engine room half full of water, and rudder control almost gone. Edwards circled the lightship for nearly 2 hours in an attempt to transfer the men. Knowing time was running out, he finally managed to come alongside. One member of his crew was swept from the Jacob's ladder by a wave, only to be snatched again from the water by the lightship's chief engineer as he rose on the crest of another wave. As the last man's foot left the 36-footer, it broke its lines and sank from sight, the only 36-foot motor lifeboat ever lost by the Coast Guard in over 7 decades of service. Despite the storm, other Coast Guard vessels and aircraft searched for the missing men the rest of the night and into the next day. Flares were dropped. Shore parties combed both sides of the river. Only two bodies were found. Culp's body came ashore near Cape Disappointment later that night, close to where his surviving crew member, Gordon Huggins, beached. The body of one of the fishermen was found a few days later. The disaster shocked residents of the small towns on the Lower Columbia. Local newspapers questioned the quality of the Coast Guard's rescue craft. A three-day inquiry was held, and all survivors provided details of what happened that night. The irony of the situation was that change was already in progress. A 44-foot all-steel motor lifeboat was going into production to be replaced to the 36-footers. The 44-footers, which had been called the best life-saving craft ever developed, were succeeded in 1990 by a new class of 47-foot aluminum motor lifeboats that are still in service. A plaque to the memory of the lost crew of Triumph was placed near the Point Adams lifeboat station in Hammond, which was closed in 1967 because it was deemed too far upriver from where it was most needed. John Culp, coxswain of Triumph, received a posthumous gold life-saving medal, the Coast Guard's highest award. His crew received silver life-saving medals, four of them awarded posthumously. Larry Edwards, coxswain of the 36-footer, lost that night, received a gold life-saving medal for his role in rescuing the crew of the 40-foot utility boat. Darrell Murray, coxswain of the 40-footer, received a commendation medal for his part in the ill-fated rescue and went on to serve the rest of a 20-year career in the Coast Guard. His visit to Astoria and the Maritime Museum in 1990 was prompted by the haunting memory of that night. Larry Edwards also spent 20 years in the Coast Guard and afterward worked for the Alaska Ferry System. A few weeks after Murray's unexpected arrival in Astoria, Edwards visited his fisherman son Blaine, who lived in Ilwaco. Asked about the night of the Triumph disaster, he responded that he had been off duty waiting for a friend when the mermaid's call was received at Cape Disappointment. He said it was, quote, dumb luck that he had seen Murray's capsized boat in the darkness in storm. He remembered seeing the Triumph with Mermaid in tow starting across the bar just after his crew rescued Murray's from the capsized 40-footer. No one now living saw the Triumph sink. Edwards said he chose to head out to sea because he was afraid his battered lifeboat would not survive crossing the bar. He drove it full throttle through mountainous seas because of his concern the sputtering engine of the 36-footer would quit. He said, I never thought about not making it. Lightship Columbia, which figures prominently in this story, was retired in 1979 after nearly 30 years' service with the Coast Guard, replaced by an automated light buoy, which locals joke looked like a large spark plug, replaced by an even more sophisticated electronic beacon. Today, Columbia Lightship is on display at the Maritime Museum and is designated a National Historic Landmark. Visitors explore her deck and interior at her quiet berth at Astoria's 17th Street Pier, where two Coast Guard cutters are often moored alongside. There have been changes in Coast Guard philosophy since the night of January 12, 1961. The old motto, "You must always go out, but you don't have to come back," has been altered to reflect the discernment of on-call rescuers. A tragic postscript to the January 12, 1961 disaster occurred on January 11, 1991, a day before a 30th anniversary commemoration and reunion in Astoria of the 11 survivors of that night initiated by Darrell Murray, coxswain of the 40-foot boat that was lost. A Coast Guard rescue swimmer and two fishermen died when a fishing boat that had been filling with water sank while under tow by a Coast Guard rescue vessel crossing the Columbia River Bar. Not only did the three men die in the same area, near Peacock Spit, the dead Coast Guardsman was from the crew of the Triumph II, which was named after the 52-foot boat that capsized with the loss of five of its crew 30 years earlier. Gordon Huggins, the single survivor of the first Triumph, was at the reunion, which was also attended by families of participants and by locals who remembered that deadly night. And if it wasn't clear, the reunion was initiated by Darrell Murray. And a postscript, again, Columbia River Bar pilot Kevin Murray fell into the Pacific Ocean on a stormy night, January 9th, 2006, while jumping from an outgoing cargo ship to the bar pilot's boat, Chinook. Captain Murray's body washed up at Copalis Beach, Washington, and was found 2.5 days later. And he was no relation to Darryl Murray. And his death occurred just before my reprint of this article in the North Coast Times-Eagle. So yesterday was the 50th anniversary of that very tragic night on the bar. Like I said, all of us on board the tuna boat that I was in when we capsized, rather well in the bar by buoy 12, we all got rescued by a puker and a gill netter and then transferred to the Coast Guard. I'd now like to read something else I wrote. I titled it, Whose Democracy Is It? My disclaimer still holds, and I dedicate it in memoriam to Christina Taylor Greene, who was murdered while attending a political gathering in Tucson, Arizona on January 8, 2011, last Saturday. She was 9 years old, born on 9/11/2001. An irony, and had recently been elected to her grammar school council, and she was there at this gathering because she wished to learn more about democracy. She was one of 6 persons shot to death, with 13 others wounded, by an assassin whose target was Arizona Democratic Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who was critically wounded but survived the attack. Christina's funeral is today. The United States is perilously close to losing one of its most fundamental precepts, one which underlies and sustains free thought and open debate, the public agreement to disagree. We are losing our civility, replacing it with intolerance, hysteria, and threatened fratricide. It seems we are more fractious and divisive than since the beginning of the first American Civil War 150 years ago. Our fractures are essentially the same as then, race and gender, framed now in overt terms of wealth. Loud voices proclaim that the United States of America is the freest, most wonderful country on earth, and unfurl the flags of worldly preeminence and godly jingoism. Quieter voices disagree, which is not to say the ideals of liberty and justice for all are not articulate in the nation, or that their intent is less than political and personal freedom, and something akin to equality under the law, however discriminatory its actual practice, for everybody now and in the future who live in this geospace. The persistent conundrum is that the actuality is far less than advertised, that neither equality or justice is the daily reality for millions of Americans who are governed instead as if they live in a police state because they are poor or are of a minority race. That the old evils of worth measured by wealth, gender, and race perversely and pervasively undercut the foundations the nation claims to stand upon and believe in. The practice of democracy in the USA has been much less than its hype, not completely a sham, but all too often a facade of liberty and equality. It has been treated as a vent for ordinary people to whimper and perhaps exercise a slim possibility to redress inequities between privilege and repression. Redress is extremely difficult to accomplish with no little bloodshed. The real power has always been with economic elites who rule as lords in a state dominated by wealth and the unvarnished aspiration to attain it. The current political climate in the United States is one of incendiary revision, which is reflected by political parties and politicians condescending to extreme right-wing ideologues and religious zealots who manipulate the democratic process to ultimately eradicate it. The party that has just regained congressional power apes the reactionary agenda so far as to echo its clarion call for a theocratic war upon anything that is different or opposes a grim and vengeful vision of apocalyptic governance that excludes diversity, intelligence, and imagination, and which blames the nation's problems on such interesting and rather progressive persons as feminists, gays and lesbians, blacks, Hispanics, and recently arrived world immigrants, in particular these days Muslims, who hope for the future rather than cling to noxious images of the past. Proto-fascists, or neoconservatives as they like to call themselves, who are determined to wrest absolute power in the United States, vent with words, although violent and extra-legal exceptions are common, and utilize old leftist liberal tactics of popular initiatives to promote laws that deny basic citizens' rights to anyone disagreeable or threatening to them. And although common sense sometimes briefly prevails over their vindictive ambitions, they will not quit in their attempts to subvert the remains of our racked democracy. They intend that those who have never enjoyed the fruits of democracy shall never reach its tree. It might be argued that such reactionary and grossly unjust attitudes are primarily based on fear, but the fear, prejudice, and absolutism they inculcate should not be lightly dismissed if democracy is to continue as a country's fundamental structure and ideal. The real issue that is ripping apart the fabric of American democracy is the disparity of wealth, which complicates and corrupts every other issue. A few white men of wealth have made an intolerable grab for power and ordination of a country club apartheid that has severely eroded the basic fiber of democracy. They have looted the public treasury of billions while increasing poverty, joblessness, as well as legal and political savagery, and their short-sighted avarice has not only bankrupted the nation, it has burdened generations with a crippling debt that will further limit options and freedoms for millions of yet unborn citizens. Politicians who are supposed to represent the people are just political real estate for rent or lease. The plutocrats, whose affluence is to a major degree based on the upward flow of money provided by the poor and middle class they incessantly impoverish, divert the nation's wealth to their own private and corporate profit. They are the source of the dissolution of the society that indulges their insatiable and arrogant avarice. Capitalism and democracy are not synonymous. During the half-century Cold War with Communist Russia, capitalism was espoused as indistinguishable from democracy. But since the collapse of communism, the ancient antipathy between power at the top and the struggle for freedom at the bottom has accelerated in the United States. The top capitalists do not believe in democracy. They believe in predatory capitalism and in their own sovereign right for power over the rest of the people. Coupled with conspicuous avarice and class discrimination, this is a recipe for disenfranchisement of ordinary Americans whose lives clearly deteriorate as a result of reactionary economic policies. Jobs lost and or sent overseas, labor unions eliminated, workers' rights and wages reduced, hours of work increased without compensation, health plans diminished or abolished, and retirement benefits dissolved. Yet even now, amidst the disastrous recession depression that has left millions of Americans out of work and homeless, people still seem indoctrinated by right-wing platitudes that socialist-style government is the problem. From the very beginning of our democracy, a powerful minority has insisted that liberty is the property of the wealthy elite and the rest of the population is to be made to serve its interests. They subscribe to a constrained interpretation of the Constitution. Its rights and privileges belong to the wealthy and propertied, its dues and obligations to everyone else. They would like to suspend the Bill of Rights and believe that what they call the original intent of the framers of the Constitution, who were all white propertied and or mercantile males, should be its only interpretation. The rigid concept of original intent is essentially religious in its implication that all progress of intellect, thought, and purpose ended with the instance of the Constitution's origin. It is an absurd and dangerous notion, contrary to the actual intent of the Constitution's authors, to make it flexible enough to reflect future problems and ideas they knew they were unable to anticipate, or too contemporarily divided in opinion to immediately resolve, among them the large movements to emancipate slaves and women. Our ancestors who wrote and ratified the Constitution knew very well that governments swallow the rights of their citizenries and that the natural inclination of authority is to concentrate and perpetuate its power by any means. Reflexively, government subverts the rights of all but its ruling classes, even if the system originated to provide rights to the governed. The laws of the Constitution, and especially the added-on Bill of Rights, simply make it more difficult for the leaders of government to make the rest of us so completely their subjects. The oligarchic, corporate, and financial aristocracy has spent the past 40 years eroding the average American's faith in constitutional government so that none will look to it to bring us out of peasantry. Unmentioned in the Constitution, but wholeheartedly advocated by so-called strict constructionists, they venture to convince us that democratic government is the enemy of the people. Yet the original intent of our founding ancestors seems to have been to accommodate the extremes of wealth and poverty, with the premise of political equality and social mobility available to all Americans. So whose democracy is it? Bernard Sanders, U.S. Senator from Vermont and Congress's only socialist, has an answer. If democracy is going to survive in this country, tens of millions of poor and working class people are going to have to see the connection between their economic condition and the political process, Sanders writes. They must vote not for the lesser of two evils, but for jobs, income, health care, and the dignity to which they, as human beings, are entitled. Only when that occurs will American democracy become revitalized. In other words, the only way to save democracy is with more democracy, and by keeping a balance between conflicting factions to allow none of them to attain such power as to be capable of suppressing or persecuting the rest. If we wish to take hope and some encouragement in the long struggle to right the balance of power in this country, perhaps it is not too late to agree with James Boyle, who wrote in the New York Times, "One reason we have a democracy is because people make unspeakably stupid decisions without it." And that was something I wrote. Whose democracy is it? And I dedicate it to Christina Taylor Greene, who was 9 years old when she was killed by an assassin. I once participated in the killing of children. It was during a war, and they were claimed to be unavoidable collateral casualties. Yet, I think it to be the most heinous and unforgivable act. And we do it every day in our wars. These days, with robotic drone predator aircraft piloted half a world away with a computer. And I think of the 1995 bombing of the Oklahoma Federal Building that particularly targeted a daycare center located in the building. At least 20 children were killed. Prior to 9/11, this was considered the worst terrorist act in American history, and it was done by Americans. Timothy McVeigh, a Persian Gulf veteran, was executed for the bombing. We are horrified when our own children are killed, but remain ambivalent about someone else's children. Well, I'd like to read a poem now. "The State of Our Democracy, The Trickle-Down Effect," an elegy for the public libraries in Jackson County, Oregon. The expected veto of the bill setting a timeline for troop withdrawal equals cut off federal reimbursements to counties for diminished timber sales, equals the complete shutdown of the entire public library system in Jackson County, equals the shattering of our country's democracy while we spend billions per week, quote, to spread democracy, unquote, somewhere else, a lie which now bleeds us in every way we can be bled. And that was written by Carolyn Dunn, who used to be a librarian for Clatsop Community College and a very good friend of mine. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.